I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll look at the artistic treasures owned by the Vatican. First, top national security officials were in Philadelphia this afternoon to review plans for next weekend's papal visit. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson says there are no credible threats against Pope Francis's first visit to the U.S.
We've worked hard to achieve what we believe will be a safe and successful event and visit by the Holy Father.
Johnson spoke at a news conference at the Multi-Agency Communications Center, set up by the Secret Service inside an industrial warehouse in northwest Philadelphia. There, officials from about 50 agencies will gather information and monitor activity around the Ben Franklin Parkway, where the Pope will have two large public events. Federal officials are aware that the tight security around the parkway and major road closures around the city have frustrated many residents and business owners. But Secret Service Director and Delaware County native Joseph Clancy says the Pope's trip to Philadelphia is unlike other big events, such as a presidential inauguration.
This one is more unique because of the amount of travel the Pope will do within the city of Philadelphia and the volume of people that are coming as well. But you have to have structure. If you don't have structure, you have mayhem.
Pope Francis arrives in Philadelphia next Saturday morning. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Pope Francis's visit to Philadelphia also marks 1 year since 43 students in Mexico vanished and are presumed to be dead in a case that remains highly disputed. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, local activists are flying five mothers of those students to Philadelphia. They're also calling on the Pope for a private meeting to discuss the tragedy.
Angelica Gonzalez and four other mothers of the 43 students who are attending a teacher's college before they disappeared are coming to the U.S. for the first time next week. It was a year ago that Gonzalez remembers the last interaction she had with her son, Jose.
And he came the night before and told her, "Mom, I'll see you when I come back," and we never saw him again.
She and the other four mothers of the missing students have been given special seats for Pope Francis's remarks on immigration and religious freedom on Independence Mall. But Gonzalez and her supporters are hoping to get some one-on-one time with the Pope.
And what we want is the government to give us the bodies or to give us our kids, because we know they have them.
Mexican officials say the 43 students were on a bus on their way to a protest when they were intercepted by corrupt police, who handed them over to a drug gang. The government says the gang killed them and incinerated their bodies in a garbage dump. But a new report by an international human rights group contradicts that account. It says there's no way the bodies were incinerated and that the government knows more than it's telling.
The emotional level of these families is so enormous because in the background, in their hearts, they think there's a remote possibility that some of them might be alive.
Pella Lara is one of the activists who's been communicating with the mothers of the missing students. She says the mystery surrounding the students' disappearance has galvanized her home country. She says even though it's been a year, there are no solid answers. But there's a lot of theories out there.
One is just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. This bus was a known drug transport, and they just happened to be there when there was this attack or this raid. The other is definitely political. There were young people who were questioning the government.
The international report said it's possible that the students were on a bus that was unknowingly transporting heroin or drug money. But others said that's not likely. They were targeted because they were driving to a mass rally commemorating the 1968 massacre when police killed scores of student demonstrators.
This disappearance of these 43 students really shocked people.
Matt Ingram is a professor at the University of Albany who studies criminal justice in Mexico. He says the fact that the students were young teachers in rural communities made the story especially stunning, and also that it looks like the local police and drug gangs worked together.
The fact that it reveals so much collusion among authorities and drug trafficking organizations at the local, state, maybe even federal level.
Over the last year, the Mexican government has arrested more than 100 people in connection with the missing 43, but they're sticking to their story that they all died from drug gangs. The mothers of the students, meanwhile, feel voiceless, and that's what the trip to Philadelphia is all about.
We think that the voice of the Pope is going to be the voice of them, of the people who don't have voice in our country. So we want that the world knows about what's happening in Mexico.
That's Marcos Urbina, another local activist who's helping the mothers get to Philadelphia. Also part of the activist group is Fidel Moreno. He says Mexico has the world's second largest number of Catholics. If the Pope calls on the government for justice, his words will carry weight.
Las madres no quieren venganza, ellas quieren justicia.
The case has to be reopened. These mothers don't want revenge. They just want justice. The idea is not revengeful, but to ask public officials to take responsibility for their role in this event.
Pope Francis has already called the student's disappearance a murder, but the activists want him to further shame the government for its handling of the case, to pressure officials to prosecute those responsible. The Mexican consulate in Philadelphia said they're aware of the new information found in the report and that they won't close the case until they have complete answers. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Stockton University announced today that it's made a deal to sell the Showboat Casino and Hotel in Atlantic City. And as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, this ends a 10-month-long saga for the South Jersey Public University.
Stockton bought Showboat in December, hoping to turn it into an Atlantic City campus, but land use restrictions on the casino killed those plans. Dr. Harvey Kesselman became president of Stockton after it bought Showboat. He says now the university will have money to focus on building a new campus instead of purchasing an existing building.
We're not in the real estate business. We're in the education business, okay? And we have to let the academic programs and our needs drive the facilities, not the other way around.
The buyer is Philadelphia real estate developer Bart Blatstein, a relative newcomer to Atlantic City who tried and failed to open a casino in Philadelphia. In June, he unveiled what's called the Playground, a complex of bars, restaurants, shops, and music venues on the Atlantic City boardwalk. He says despite Atlantic City's financial troubles, he's got faith the shore town will bounce back.
Look, if I wasn't happy, I wouldn't be buying more. So I'm buying what I can get my hands on.
When asked why he would buy Showboat a year after one-third of Atlantic City's casinos shut down, he was quick with a joke.
I always wanted a boat.
But he is not saying whether he will open it as a gaming venue or try something else to keep Showboat afloat. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Turning to this evening's headlines, a doomed short-term funding measure is headed to the Pennsylvania State House after passing in the Senate. Republicans say the funding package would ensure money for schools and social service providers while budget talks continue. But Democratic Governor Tom Wolf says he will veto it. He denounces the GOP's stance as disingenuous. Democratic State Senator Vincent Hughes of Philadelphia says it's the wrong time to offer a stopgap measure.
We should be at the budget table negotiating a budget. We should not be at the microphone. We should be at the table. This bill is another gimmick.
The $11 billion plan would release 4 months of retroactive state funding for schools, social services, and other programs, as well as a full year of federal funds. The measures also contain millions of dollars for other projects, including security for the Pope's upcoming visit to Philadelphia. The GOP-controlled House is expected to take up the measure next week. Mostly clear skies, 82 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:13. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Clear skies overnight, falling back to 65 degrees. Sunny again tomorrow, Saturday's high in the mid-80s. Sunday, partly sunny, a little cooler, high 78. Still ahead, a 2012 law was supposed to make it easier for Pennsylvania cities to get blighted properties into the hands of new owners, but that's not happening.
We're all frustrated in how difficult it is and how complex, so there is a level of frustration.
We'll look at why land bank programs are so sluggish when Newsworks Tonight continues.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. A Philadelphia Orchestra showpiece, Yannick Nezet-Séguin conducts Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. Plus, Daniil Trifonov plays Rachmaninoff's fourth piano concerto. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. October 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th at the Kimmel Center, Scheherazade with Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Bryn Mawr Rehab supports WHYY and for more than 40 years has been committed to delivering advanced physical rehab services to those recovering from serious illness or injury. Their team of specialists develops customized inpatient and outpatient treatment plans for a range of conditions, including brain injury, spinal cord injury, concussion, and stroke. Patients travel from across the country for Bryn Mawr Rehab Hospital's creativity and personalized therapeutic approach. Learn more, including real patient stories, at mainlinehealth.org/rehab.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA welcomes everyone to join their community of artists of all ages and levels of experience, featuring classes in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, plus pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and weekend master classes with noted artists David Wiesner, Elizabeth Osborne, and Renee Folks. Registration now open. Classes begin September 17th. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. We're now just 4 days out from Pope Francis's first trip ever to America. Landing in the nation's capital Tuesday afternoon in advance of visits to New York City, and of course Philadelphia next weekend. Let's focus on Catholicism in the United States with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, first up, is it true that the Pope is coming to the most Catholic region in the nation?
He is. The Mid-Atlantic region in general, and that includes New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, is the most Catholic region in the country. Overall, 24% of Americans identify as Catholic, and that's pretty interesting because that's been stable over time. We've seen the percent of Americans who are Protestant come down over the decades, and that's been matched by an increase in the percent who say they don't have a religious identification. But for a variety of demographic reasons, the percent Catholic has remained stable in that 20 to 25% level. But when you come to our region in this area, much higher, New Jersey, 40% Catholic. That's the fourth most Catholic state in the Union after Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. Pennsylvania is at 28.4% Catholic, a little above average, but not a lot. And Delaware is a little lower at 26% Catholic, still slightly above average.
How does Gallup go about measuring how religious members of different faiths are?
We ask about religious service attendance, which a lot of our research literature shows is actually a pretty good indicator. Even if people overreport how often they go to church, it's still a pretty good indicator of how religious they are underneath it all. And we also ask attitudinally, how important is religion to you in your daily life? In relating to Catholics, Dave, there's no question that the high religiosity among Catholics has fallen over the years. It used to be the church attendance was much higher among Catholics, and now, and this is an important factoid, Catholics actually report attending church less frequently than Protestants. 37% of Catholics say they go weekly or almost every week, and that's 41% among Protestants. So in terms of religious service attendance, Catholics have now slipped below the 50% of Americans that are Christian, but not Catholic.
Frank, does Gallup look even more narrowly at the religiosity of Hispanic Catholics?
We do. Hispanics are a big component of the Catholic faith. They're about a little more than a third of Catholics now in the U.S. are Hispanic, and the Hispanic percentage, at least in our surveys, is about 15%, give or take. So you can see Catholics depend on Hispanics, and that's one of the reasons that the percentage of Americans who are Catholics has stayed constant because of the influx of Catholic Hispanics over the years. Hispanics are only slightly more religious, interestingly, than other Catholics, but they are a little more religious, and that helps a little keep the religiosity of Catholics from going even lower.
Frank, let's turn to politics, and let's allow the dust to settle following Wednesday's GOP debate. Turning to the Democratic ledger, what's the latest regarding frontrunner Hillary Clinton?
Well, her favorable numbers have been coming down, and that's what we track. But we have a very important new bit of information here. A couple of weeks ago, we asked Americans every single night, what have they heard or read about Hillary Clinton recently? And what we found is that overwhelmingly, what Americans reported back to us was they have heard about emails, email servers, the email scandal while she was Secretary of State, and then some Benghazi mentions as well. We can't find almost any mentions of policy, where she stands on an issue like the economy or what she would do about moral issues or anything along those lines or international issues. She's lost control of the message, in other words.
So emails and Hillary Clinton, what's the word association with Bernie Sanders?
A socialist. Plus, there's mentions of the fact that he's doing well in the polls and doing better along those lines, but he's clearly has a defined image to the left of the spectrum, and probably in terms of being elected in a general election, that's not optimal.
Is Donald Trump tapping into Americans' priorities when he focuses on immigration?
It's actually been rising, and of course, this is circular. We have more Americans in our just updated What's the Most Important Problem Facing the Country measure, saying immigration, that did so in the past. But we don't know whether that's Trump who's tapping into that or Trump's focus on that has actually caused some of that increase. It's still not number one. The top problem facing the country today is dysfunctional government. Then the economy, and then immigration comes in as number three.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. There are some neighborhoods in Pennsylvania cities where half of the properties are blighted or tax delinquent or both. There are some 60,000 such properties between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and getting them into the hands of new owners who can make them useful for the neighborhood again is complicated. A 2012 state law was intended to streamline that process, though in reality, the efforts to create the state's two biggest land banks hasn't even gotten out of the boardroom. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zhorov reports from Pittsburgh. We'll also hear from Jared Bray of Plan Philly about how Philadelphia is doing.
On a recent afternoon, the Pittsburgh Land Bank's full board met for the first time. Councilman Ricky Burgess, chairman of the board, called it a historic moment. They have their work cut out for them. The interim board, named in April 2014, was supposed to have already drafted policies and procedures. They were also supposed to have come up with a strategic plan by last April. Neither of those things has happened. Here's Ricky Burgess.
Well, one of the problems was that the interim board had difficulty doing its job. In fact, it never did do its job.
So the newly seated board is now catching up. But there are other holdups. The city, which owns about 11,000 parcels of land, will transfer some of the properties to the land bank. But it hasn't yet figured out which ones.
We've intentionally delayed this.
That's Pittsburgh Mayor's Chief of Staff, Kevin Acklin.
We could easily have the land bank up and operating. We don't yet have it fixed in terms of how we convey properties to them.
Acklin says the land bank is just one piece of a larger reevaluation of how Pittsburgh should manage vacant properties as the city grows and changes. What parcels should go to the Urban Redevelopment Authority, which focuses on growing the tax base? What parcels should become part of the city's green infrastructure? And what should go in the land bank for community-driven development? Currently, individual siloed agencies make those decisions, but they've started coordinating. Pittsburgh has lost half of its population, and Kira Straussman with the URA says it's time for the city to think strategically.
We're talking about the land, and I think making sure that you're handling it with coherent policies that meet community demands, that are strong for our city as a future city. You know, you want to take the time to get it right.
Burgess, the board chairman, wants to have an operational land bank by January. It's unclear if the city will have its process sorted out by then. Even if it does, it could take another 18 months to prepare the first batch of properties for resale. Irina Zhorov reporting from Pittsburgh.
I'm Jared Bray in Philadelphia, which is a bit ahead of Pittsburgh in getting its land bank going. The land bank is now incorporated, it has a permanent board, and it has a strategic plan. One thing it still doesn't have, though, is land, and that's a source of stress for Barbara Hill Cisse, a West Kensington resident who's been trying to get a hold of the vacant lot next to her house for the last 7 years.
I've had neighbors try to use it for trash and scrap metal and to fix cars, etc.
At one point, Hill Cisse won the property as the only bidder at a sheriff's sale auction. She paid a deposit, but she thought she had more time to pay off the balance, and after 30 days, she lost the property and her deposit. Now, it's going back through the sheriff's sale process again.
I'm just in limbo. I mean, I'm just expecting somebody to come with a sign, knock down, bulldozer, build something. I don't even know what's going on right now.
She hoped the land bank would put an end to the ordeal once and for all, and maybe it will. But John Carpenter, the deputy director of the new agency, said everyone expected it would take a while to get rolling.
We knew there were a lot of things we needed to do before we could get the land bank up and running. The biggest sort of first one was just getting the strategic plan underway. That was almost a year's worth of work.
The strategic plan lays out policies for how the land bank will get properties into the right hands. The board is also in the middle of creating a policy for acquiring new land. But the biggest obstacle so far is labor negotiations. One of the four city unions who will be staffing the land bank is holding out for a better contract. Here's Michael Kuntz, the director of the land bank and of the union that's still negotiating.
We've made progress, but it's been slow. I'd like to speed it up. I would have liked to have seen it completed 6 or 8 months ago, but it's a process.
One person who's familiar with delays is Councilwoman Maria Quinones Sanchez. She sponsored the land bank bill in city council, and her district has more vacant land than anywhere else in the city.
We're all frustrated in how difficult it is and how complex, given union negotiations and contracts and the different agencies involved, how this all comes together. So there is a level of frustration.
Sanchez hopes the labor negotiations will wrap up soon and that the land bank will start turning over properties. For Plan Philly, I'm Jared Bray.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the four-station initiative. With all the talk of humility and simplicity surrounding Pope Francis, it's possible to overlook the Vatican's artistic wealth and gilded exuberance. Not to worry. The new exhibition at the Franklin Institute, Vatican Splendors, is a pilgrimage through the Catholic Church's treasures in art and architecture. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez-Luna found out it's also an exploration of the intersection of art, faith, and science.
The 200 objects in the exhibition tell several stories, all centered on the Vatican's power and influence, and not just in religious matters. Brother Charles Hilken, historical consultant for the show, says it begins when the church was an underground movement.
The church for its first several centuries, of course, was an illegal group without any means of expressing itself in art or in architecture. And then once it was legal to be Christian, it had to find ways of expressing the faith. And so the first kind of Christian art is heavily dependent on ancient Greco-Roman models.
That evolution is displayed through paintings, carvings, documents, maps, and other artifacts. Visitors can also communicate, so to speak, with Pope St. John Paul II by putting their hands in a bronze mold of his hand. This is a dialogue between art and faith, says Hilken. We stop in front of a small, touchingly domestic painting by renowned 17th century artist Giovanni Francesco Barbieri. It portrays Mary teaching baby Jesus how to read.
We know that Jesus eventually stood up in synagogue and read from the scriptures, and he had to learn it from somewhere.
In Splendors, there are minuscule ex votos and imposing sculptures, chalices decorated with precious stones, and simple vessels of gold and silver. There's even an invoice signed by Michelangelo and the first map of Australia. Monsignor Luis Manuel Cunha Ramos, who heads the Vatican's Congregation of the Evangelization of the People, says cartography was an important part of spreading the gospel, mapping where missionaries were going. So was learning and printing in different languages.
In 1627, was a polyglot printing press was founded. Printing press could print books in 22 Oriental languages, which means that it was a very important investment in culture. And in so many occasions, the missionaries were the first ones to create and to compose the first dictionaries, the first grammars in so many languages.
As fitting for a science museum, Vatican Splendors explores art preservation and the materials used to create these works, ranging from inks to paint to stone to metals. There's a keen emphasis on architecture and the builders hired to construct landmark Vatican buildings. The exhibition is divided in thematic rooms. A passageway between two centuries is built as a makeshift scaffold, giving you an idea of what it was like for Michelangelo to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Vatican Splendors, A Journey Through Faith and Art, will close at the Franklin Institute on October 4th. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Alex Lewis and Brett Rader, and we welcome our new intern, Kevin Rowley. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks. Joyce Lieberman is our radio engineering supervisor. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.